ça change, plus c'est la même chose. And the rest of the sermon is going to be in French too. No, it's not. I'm a show off, but not. I can't do that. The more things change is what that means, the more they remain the same. And we hear this epigram often. This morning, I am taking enthusiastic exception to this piece of fatalistic philosophy. Change happens, yes, of course, all the time. And when a transition is navigated mindfully and bravely, things can end up in a different place. Transformation can be the result, as a matter of fact. We heard, Wanda read a brief excerpt from William Bridges, who is a famous and excellent consultant that I recommend highly. His books about transition are great. But this is a church service. So here are three poems that give us a more spiritual, emotional take on his stages of ending, in between, or what he sometimes calls the neutral zone, and beginning. The first poem is by Rumi, who was a 13th century Sufi mystic, and he captures the true unknowingness that we have to acknowledge and live into when we are living in the inadequately named neutral zone. It's neutral in that it's not the ending and it's not the beginning, but it sure doesn't feel neutral. Rumi, of course, recommends that we live like this all the time, not just in transition, which is, in fact, a very important point. How we are when we're not experiencing change is likely to be how we'll be when we are. Rumi knows that we don't have control of our journey no matter what we think. He knows that we have to be open and faithful and to live as joyously as possible in the uncertainty. He knows that we have to be willing to be changed, to be broken open by and to the miraculous. Rumi says, "Be helpless, dumbfounded, unable to say yes or no. Then a stretcher will come from grace to gather us up. We are too dull-eyed to see that beauty. If we say we can, we're lying. If we say no, we don't see it, that no will behead us and shut tight our window onto spirit. So let us rather not be sure of anything beside ourselves and only that, so miraculous beings come running to help. Crazed, lying in a zero circle, mute, we shall be saying finally with tremendous eloquence, lead us. When we have totally surrendered to that beauty, we shall be a mighty kindness." The next poem is by another Muslim mystic, Kabir. If you haven't noticed and you care, I did have the poems printed in the order of service. I believe they have some typos, which I fixed in the manuscript. But so that if you are a visual person and wants to go to read along, I wanted you to be able to do that. Sometimes that's easier with poetry. If you're someone who learns by listening, just open your ears and hear. Kabir is the 15th century Muslim mystic, and he gives a little more apparent comfort to modern people by assuring us that we can actually do something. But listen carefully to this poem. The doing arises from a holy longing, not from intellectual determination and inflexible aiming toward preconceived goals. Kabir's passionate doing is grounded in that strange and wondrous thing that we feel in our souls as awe and reverence. And again, what we choose to be now is what we will be when we come up against the unknown. Kabir says, "Friend, hope for the guest while you are alive. Jump into experience while you are alive. Think and think while you are alive. What you call salvation belongs to the time before death. If you don't break your ropes while you're alive, do you think ghosts will do it after? The idea that the soul will rejoin with the ecstatic just because the body is rotten, that is all fantasy. What is found now is found then. If you find nothing now, you will simply end up with an apartment in the city of death. If you make love with the divine now, in the next life, you will have the face of satisfied desire. So plunge into the truth, find out who the teacher is, believe in the great sound." Kabir says this, "When the guest is being searched for, it is the intensity of the longing for the guest that does all the work. Look at me, and you will see a slave of that intensity." And now from our modern scripture writer, Mary Oliver. She acknowledges the horrible chaos that can surround and dwell within us during the in-between time. Oliver knows that the chaos of ending and in-between involve tough times with other people, either real ones or ones that we project onto them. She lifts up the result of having the faith and the braveness to stay in the breaking open process. She lifts up what gradually happens as we trudge and fight and shamble our way through the repatterning. The bright new does emerge. Mary Oliver says this, "One day you finally knew what you had to do and began. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles, 'Mend my life,' each voice cried, but you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough, and a wild night and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save." The message that I take from our faithful poets over the centuries and from William Bridges is that if we are to find transformation and a brighter world through change and transition, we need to take exquisite care, spiritually and emotionally. Taking care means bringing our best selves to the process, and it means that we will probably be broken open. It means understanding that we will not always be our best selves, but we may be angry or blaming or depressed or withdrawn or even mean. And then asking forgiveness, forgiving ourselves, and moving on. Taking care means staying wide open to what Zorba the Greek calls the whole catastrophe of life. Taking care may involve strategic plans and definite goals and other mundane organized processes in the world. I want you to be sure to hear that I am not against such activities. It's just this morning I'm mostly talking about the spiritual and emotional part of this journey. It all mushes up together. Taking care means having faith that a new beginning will bring ease and new depths of soul. Having that faith, no matter what. I remember one morning, in the midst of the 2 or 3 years at least that I wandered in grief and confusion after my younger sister Kate's death, I swung my weary feet out of bed to face one more dragging through molasses day. I said out loud, I will be so glad when it isn't an effort just to get up in the morning. I was stuck pretty badly at that moment. I was a mess for a pretty long time. And I knew it. I also had unshakable faith that I would be better someday. I was, and I am, after a long time of radical openness and being genuinely broken open. I can sometimes now feel Kate's presence across time and space. I couldn't then. In preparing for this sermon, I asked if people had ideas and stories to share about change and transition. And a few did. Almost all of them underscoring my realization that we journey through large and small transitions best by being open, by paying mindful attention to what is going on, and not by acting as though our time schedule and expectations control the process. Jeanette Ross was very helpful in her commentary about institutional change. She begins her email by speaking of a recent and protracted conflict in an institution that is very dear to her. And she looks at it in hindsight as bringing wisdom about what she calls a continuum of change, one edge and the other. And here, this is Jeanette's words now. She says, one edge is an ideal outcome, transformative change, that which has gone beyond resolving differences to modifying the conditions, structural and attitudinal, that produced conflict. The approach toward transformation is a long series of small steps, adjustments, aha moments, apologies, false starts, redirects, etc. Each is a step into the unknown, an encounter, honest sharing, finding commonalities and compromising on differences in an atmosphere of trust and willingness to change. At each step, an effort is made to acknowledge and consider both facts and feelings. She speaks of going through transition with great care. She acknowledges the humanity of all people involved in institutional change with those ahas and false starts and apologies and redirects. And she echoes our faithful poets in that phrase, a step into the unknown, spiritual openness. She acknowledges that change brings all kinds of emotions and counsels honesty, trust, and willingness to change. Not incidentally, the other edge of her continuum of change is, and this is a quote, a series of events that escalate differences where facts get interpreted in differing ways, denied, ignored, cherry-picked, differences are muddled by emotion. Now that fits my experience too. I really appreciated her insightful commentary about institutional change, because we, in fact, we're a church, but we are an institution always going through change, including the fairly big one of my retirement in a year and a half. And I think maybe we should make a poster of her description of the positive ways of journeying through change. That would be a very good thing. Now, the other four correspondents, the other four people who responded to me, spoke of personal change. Speaking of surrendering, one person talked about living through the pain with as little anger as possible, thus creating a very good new beginning. Someone talked about being sure beginnings are honored. And one person echoed this morning's theme by saying she's learning to, quote, live in the present, live in uncertainty. Here are a couple of stories now about death, which is that transition that affects us temporary survivors so very, very deeply. The first one is about a man I occasionally see and hear in the Alcoholics Anonymous meetings that I go to. Now, I speak as one who does not know him personally, so I'm telling you this entirely from my perceptions of him as he shares in meetings. So I could be unfair. This could be a hypothetical that's wrong. His wife died 3 years ago at a fairly young age. Now, of course, he spoke rendingly and tearfully of his loneliness, his regrets, his terrible grief, how he depended on her. The 3 years have gone by. I could be entirely wrong in my perceptions of him, but it sounds to me as though he hasn't even gotten through Bridges' first step of understanding that a true ending has actually happened. He still speaks tearfully of his loneliness, his regrets, his terrible grief, and how he depended on her. He sounds exactly as he did when it happened. Now, I feel like a heartless wretch, and I might be. I mean, he may be on a numinous inner journey about which I have no clue, in which case I offer my heart's apologies to the universe. If I am right, and we'll just assume that, even though I might not be, he is an example of someone who simply hasn't been able to embark on the transition path, even less to do it with openness and care. If I am right, his spirit is sinking into a cycle of unmindful sameness and dependency, lacking, at least for now, the courage it takes to wend one's way through the complex ups and downs that characterize the difficult process of healthy transition. I'm going to close now with a story from someone here in our church. Before that, I want to ask us all to reflect on these questions. Can we, with each other's help and the grace of God, have the courage to feel our endings and let go? Can we, now do we have the patience and the humility to stay open as long as necessary to the buffetings of the in-between transition period? Do we have the faith and the creativity to work with those breaking open forces to honor the intensity of the longing for mystery? And can we recognize the beginning, the place where the weaving starts after all of that unraveling, and honor it in light and joy? Here's the story. Deb Eisinger lost her 27-year-old son, John, on November 25th, 2010, after he had had illnesses of various kinds. Deb says this: Boof has given me the support to survive the 14 months of change I've had to make since my son died I actually tried on ideas about what happens after death, while also having the opportunity to think about how I want to live my life to honor his memory. The tattooed sentiment he had across his chest, "Live the life you love, love the life you live," is now engraved on a bracelet I wear all the time, reminding me to move forward. With professional help, I made a lovely quilt of his numerous quirky t-shirts. My image of my son moves from a more traditional heaven, where he hangs out with our departed dogs, to a dark, blank space, to my most recent idea suggested by a Catholic friend in Costa Rica, that he went through a tunnel to a place of bright white light and unconditional love. The openness of the UU tradition has helped me move through a year of deep mourning to a place of lifelong gentle grieving that I'm learning to make part of my daily life. You don't usually get to choose what you lose, but you can choose how to deal with it.